Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of She's the Barista. Ja, hallo. It's very great to have you all back, and hello to everyone who is listening for the first time. This podcast is kindly supported by Rancilio Germany, so thank you so much for making this possible. And it is the week between the years, and I hope you guys could spend some time with your friends and with your family. And this week's episode is actually quite fitting because I'm interviewing an old friend of mine, Charlotte Malaval, and I met in Australia, and we actually, no joke, we met at my wedding. And now I took the chance to actually ask her everything about her career and about her life and coffee. But before I start spilling all the tea, let's welcome her. And here she is. Welcome, everyone. Hello, Charlotte. How are you?
Hey, Nicole. I'm so good. Thank you. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm. We already said it a little bit. For me, it's 8 o'clock in the morning now, and for you, it's 6.
Yeah, it's about 6 p.m.
That is crazy. That has a reason why we have such a big time difference, and that's because of where you are in the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation you're in the moment?
So right now I'm home in Sydney, so in Australia, recovering from the Christmas weekend. So just like basically staying home because it's been raining nonstop for the last like 3 months, I think. So
what?
Yeah, it's a little sad for summer in Australia.
Wow. So we just had Christmas. How was it? Did you have a ton of food?
Way too much food and way too much champagne as well. Oh, so nice. That's what, like, basically spend the whole day at home doing nothing, which was amazing.
Mm. Yeah, and also having like a hot Christmas, a warm Christmas is very, very different to the European cold Christmas where
Well,
we have minus 17 degrees this night.
Ouch. Oh, that hurts. But at the same time, that's what you want for Christmas. You want to be cold and you want to be like, you know, home in front of a beautiful fire. And but as I told you, like this way, I don't feel like, you know, homesick because it's so warm and it just doesn't feel like Christmas at all.
But what I'm already realizing is that it kicks in now already after the second day. It's like, oh my God, I feel so gross and fat. So my New Year's resolutions are coming by. They're coming along nicely because I'm definitely have to do sport after this.
Yeah, that's what I say every year after the New Year. And then it lasts for like a few weeks. And then I'm like, look, I'm done.
Oh, you have the benefit that you go surfing all the time, right?
Yeah, I know, but I told you with the weather now, it's not so like it's not so attracting right now to go out surfing. But I should.
I thought when it's rainy and when it's stormy, it's actually good because there's
all big waves. Yeah, but I don't surf big waves. That's why I don't go. Unfortunately, I'm not good enough. Good. Exactly, it's just for the style, you know.
I'm in Australia. I have to go surfing.
Exactly. So you get your visa. You're allowed to have a visa if you show you have a surfboard.
That's why I didn't get it. Oh no, everything's clear. So you're in Sydney and I'm all the way over here in Germany. We're all both just recovering from Christmas. But obviously you're not originally from Sydney. You moved from France, and there's a very big backstory to this, so everything must have happened for a reason. Let's just start with your start in coffee, I guess. How did you start in coffee? How did this whole madness begin?
All right. So that's a long story, but I tried to make it short. Basically, I was just at university. I studied cultural anthropology and ethnology, and I was just drinking bad coffee like everyone in France, you would imagine. I had no idea about specialty coffee, what it was about or anything. And one day by chance, I tried one specialty espresso. And I remember it was a fully washed Ethiopian, like pretty much 90% of the people that fell into specialty coffee. And I was like, oh my God, what is this coffee? I find it terrible. And I was like, this is so weird. Like, it's so gross. Why is it so different? Because I used to drink bad coffee with sugar, right? Like the actual proper French way. And the guy's like, oh, don't worry about it. It's a single origin. It comes from Ethiopia. It's a fully washed coffee. And I was like, wait. What are you talking about? Like, single origin, fully washed. Like, what is all this about? And he's like, yeah, that's, you know, like the way the coffee is processed. And it's just a unique lot from one single country. It's not a blend. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. Like, I don't like the taste at all, but it's so weird that coffee can taste like this. And the barista was like, cool, let me make you another coffee. And I think, I don't remember what he did, but he probably made me another kind of profile, probably a natural process. And I was like, wow, it tastes so different. So I was so amazed that it was tasting so different. Even I didn't like it, I was just amazed. And so I was asking him like thousands of questions. And he told me like, look, if you're interested, you can come. Like, we do like little barista classes. You can sign up and you come here for 4 days and we teach you like how to set a grinder or to make espresso. And we talk a little bit about coffee in general. And I'm like, yeah, 100%. Like, sign me up. I want to come and do the class. And so I just did this because I was curious. I didn't want to have a career in coffee or anything like this. I just did that like you would do, I don't know, a wine tasting over the weekend just for fun. So that was kind of how I did, how I get into coffee for the first time. And after this week, like trying to like make espresso and learn about a tiny bit, because of course, when you do those classes, it's really surface level, but I was just so passionate about it and I loved it. And so that's how I started. And I was still doing my first year of master at uni, I think. And I was working for some companies, you know, like on booths, like on trade shows, like, you know, doing the dishes and washing the things for on the booth, like at different coffee trade shows. And then started like walking behind the machine and I was doing some classes, like helping people, like doing the classes, just like at the same time, I was still like doing my master degree. I did like kind of helped the people at this training center I went to and walk a bit like, yeah, for different brands of coffee machine manufacturers. And that's how I started in coffee, really. Just out of curiosity, to be honest.
When was that, roundabout?
That was in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
2013 maybe, I think.
So you did not work as a full-time barista, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. I just worked like on different events and then I was like helping doing barista classes.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end it was me, like I ended up like running the classes myself, really.
Wow.
But yeah. I was, then I worked like for different like yeah coffee machine manufacturers, brands of grinders, and I was an ambassador for like different products. And then I moved, not really moved, but I started working a lot in Italy with Francesco. So that's how I've learned the most of what I know, of course, because I was working a little bit at Dita and with Francesco as well in his training center. And so I get the chance to start traveling a little bit.
Mm, can you quickly explain to our listeners who Francesco is?
Oh, so Francesco Sanapo is the owner of Dita Artigianale in Florence.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a coffee roaster, but they also have different cafes and training centers around Florence. And they sell coffee. I think they sell coffee everywhere in Europe. And now they're expanding in North America as well. So they're growing a lot.
Yeah, he's everywhere. He's great in terms of like he also really knows everyone.
I know.
Which is incredible. So that escalated quickly, I would say, in your career. So you went from doing your master's to being an ambassador for different brands and everything. And then was your first championship in 2014?
It was, yeah. I think I competed the first time in 2014 and I had literally no idea about what I was doing at all. I just like, people told me, oh, you should compete. And I was like, yeah, cool. Like, I was really competitive. Like, I was like, I love to compete. Like, in anything, I would compete, no problems. So I just watched some, like, kind of YouTube video you would find. And, you know, like, I didn't know anyone in coffee. So I was just, oh, this guy from Guatemala looks good. Raul, like, yeah, I tried to do something like this. Like, oh, my God, I had no idea what I was looking at. And I was just, like, trying to kind of copy and paste the thing I was, like, watching from other baristas and found a coffee. And I was really bad. Really, I don't know if you probably can find this somewhere online. That would be hilarious to watch. And that was really bad. And then I'm like, okay, it's embarrassing. So I did the comp, and then I'm like, look, I want to take a few years. I want to learn more about coffee because I realize I don't know anything about it, and I can't compete if I don't know anything about coffee. Mm. And so I'm like, I want to take some time to rest and learn and try to grow, and then okay, I'll compete again. And that's when I met Francesco. I think we were at a trade show in Belgium, in Ghent. And he's like, oh, are you Charlotte? No, no, no. Like, I've seen you in some events. Like, are you competing this year again? And I'm like, oh, no, 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 no. I'm not competing. I want to learn more about coffee first, and then I'll compete again. And he's like, you're so wrong. Like, you should not do this. Like, you should use competition as a way to learn, and you're way too young not to compete. So even if you don't know anything about coffee and if you have no idea, just compete, just because that's how you're going to learn things. And I was like, yeah, maybe, but comp is in only like a few months. I'm not ready. I don't have a coffee. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he's like, don't worry about it. Like, if you decide to do it, I'll help you. Come to Florence, spend a few days with me, and we can find a coffee together, and I'll coach you and help you, and we can figure it out. And I was like, no, 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 I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And he just insisted so much. And then I realized, like, look, I can't say no. Like, this guy is offering me, like, help to help me compete and help me learn and help me, like, you know, like, develop my knowledge and skills. Like, of course I have to say yes, even if I end up last at the competition. So I said yes and flew to Florence, and I think I stayed there for a few days. We picked a coffee, came back to France, and ended up winning the nationals, which was kind of so unexpected.
In 2015?
That was in 2015, exactly. And then we're like, oh my God, now we're in trouble. So I was like, I don't want to go to world and be like embarrassing. So I spent so much time in Italy, and we practiced like for nonstop until the world championship, because also I didn't speak any English. So I had to learn English.
Oh, wow.
So that was pretty tough, but that was amazing. Look, I still can't believe we did that well on the first year. Like, the second year was completely different because I think I knew what I was getting into. So the preparation and everything was completely different, because this time I had expectations and others had expectations. So that was a completely different competition for Dublin. But Seattle, I was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe, like, every announcement. I was like, what? Are you guys sure? Like, are you sure I went to semifinals?
So what you already
double check.
Yeah. So what you already a little bit revealed now is that the year afterwards you again won nationals. So you again went to worlds. And your first worlds was in 2015 in Seattle. And like you said, you were so surprised because of all of the announcement, because you actually made it to the finals, right?
Yeah, no, I just couldn't believe it. That first year, I was so amazed. I was so happy, look, like, because we worked so hard at the same time. But I was, you know, like, when you see everyone and they're just all so good and you tried everyone's coffee, and you're like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. And when you've been to Worlds many times, I think it's not as impressive. But when it's the first time you get there and you see everyone backstage, like, they're all so professional and they know what they're doing, and they got all those strong teams. And it was kind of me and Francesco, but what a great team as well with us, like, helping. That was amazing. But I was, you know, like a little kid in Disneyland being like, wow, that's amazing.
And you placed fifth, right?
As the first year I placed sixth, and the second year I play fifth. I just go one ranking at a time, you know? pretty slow.
Okay. So what did I want to say? So you've had this whole experience from this first time competing in Seattle, well, not your first time ever, but like this first time on this big stage, and you made it directly to finals. And this is so hard, and this is so unheard of. Is it true? I always have to ask, because I don't know if I'm correct in this, that you were the first woman that made it to finals, and then Mickey?
I think Mickey made it first. I think she made finals first, okay? Yeah, before me. So Mickey was the first ever.
Okay.
And then I think it was me for 2 years, and then Mickey came back, and then many women ended up in the finals and winning.
But you have one of, so Miki Suzuki is from Japan.
Japan, yeah.
Oh, she's amazing. She's a lovely, she's the best. She's yeah. just the cutest.
I know.
Also the same struggle, didn't speak English before. Had to learn English for the routine.
And
speak coach and everything. Anyway, you're probably the second woman ever who made it to the finals of the WBC, and this 15 years after the first WBC has ever been in the cup. So it's been 15 years until a woman placed in the finals, and then it just snowballed from that. Do you think that you, with your presentation and your presence on stage, made a difference and inspired people?
Yeah. I mean, I hope so, more because of I think the concept of the routine and the coffee represented, and the whole approach that we had, our perspective about what coffee was and what excellence is in our specialty coffee industry. I hope this is what inspired people more than my gender in the end. Because for me, I look up to people, like I can't really see gender. Like I look at someone, like I'm inspired by their value and what they would represent and things like this. So for me, like, yeah, I hope people enjoy like the message I wanted to share on stage for sure.
I still remember one of them. I don't know if it was the one in Dublin. I think it was the one in Dublin where your concept was about temperature and your signature drink was different temperatures just mixed together of the same coffee.
Yeah, that was in Seattle actually. The whole concept was about the temperature of like every single step of the coffee chain. Like it's always impacted by temperature, either on the farm level, processing, drying, of course roasting, extracting and drinking coffee. And you've been talking about that as well yourself, so
yeah. I remember watching this and I was just so blown away by you just like presenting the same coffee as your signature drink, because signature drinks, as we all know, are like they're sometimes really awful and they're really hard to design because you have to reinvent the wheel. And you just said, oh, I'm just going to take the same coffee in like cold, medium and hot and then just put it together and that's the signature drink. And it worked and it's incredible. I love this. So everyone who has no clue what I'm talking about now because I'm too excited, just watch Charlotte's routine from 2015.
Thank you so much.
I was blown away. I thought this was so smart and so clever.
Oh, thanks.
That definitely was an inspiration for me, being like, temperature, that's a great one.
But then I feel like also what you were saying about like the woman in competition and WBC is really an interesting and difficult question to answer, because I think like to answer this, you might want to look deeper into, let's say, actually the roots of anthropology of games and competition in the world, right? Because the concept of competition has always been about questioning what makes us human. And why I'm telling you that is because playing is kind of universal and natural, but games or competitions are really specific to each society. Mm-hmm. And you kind of learn those games through education. And so the interesting part is that families or communities, they place really specific and different expectations on men and women to play different roles in our society and to play these games or those competitions and be playing them well. And a lot of these roles in different games are learned according to your gender. And in most societies, male and female energy are made to complement each other, so they're really different. And at the end of the day, you can decide for yourself if it's nature or culture, but there is, I think, one of my first answers about why there are less female competing in barista competition or in any competition in general is because in most societies, males are perceived as, you know, the more aggressive type and competitive, and, you know, the men go to war and they defend women and kids because they're stronger and they are providers, and female on the opposite is like, okay, the ones responsible for the successful development and preservation of life, and they're more cautious and intuitive, and they have more like sedentary behavior, let's say. This is not true for everyone at all, but this is what the society creates, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about barista competition, it's like going to war. So it requires lots of confidence and brings a lot of stress. There is a huge amount of work as well and some fear too because of the risks of losing or failing. And those risks and issues, they are the same for both genders. Either you're male or female. It has nothing to do about being a woman. It's about being human. And in my opinion, it's actually maybe worse for men. And this is when you go back to anthropology and you realize that there is a much higher risk and pressure for men, because men competing is a requirement. Like, it's an expectation from our society. Because men, they need to demonstrate their men by competing or by leading or fighting in general. So there is a higher risk and pressure for men. And sometimes men would be considered as inferior if they don't compete. So sometimes I'm like, oh, like, guys, like, instead of saying like it's sad that not many women are competing, maybe, I don't know, it's just an idea. We could give it another perspective and maybe say it's sad for men to be so many to compete and not for women to be only a few, yeah. Right? Because for women, it's not really a commandment from our society to compete. Women compete only if they want to compete themselves. And in most of the cases, women are not normally raised as competitors. And again, of course, there are exceptions. We all have different stories. Like for me, I've always been raised like this, like it's part of my education, let's say. For me, it was a great key to reach higher potential and pushing myself to, I don't know, personal excellence, if you want to call it that way. Sorry. It was a strong aspect of my personal life and evolution, and not only in coffee. So for me, I was always been like part of my education of since I was a little girl, like, okay, horse riding, you're going to compete. Piano, you're going to compete. Badminton, you're going to compete. And then, of course, coffee. Now I'm like, I want to compete as well. But we all have different educations, but I think that's really an important part of it is our society and the norms and the expectations they put on us.
That is super interesting and super, you just said that perfectly and extremely smart. So thank you for that.
But again, like we can have all different opinions, but I feel like sometimes we often think as patriarchy, like hurting women. But we don't talk about how it can also hurt men. And now I feel like we are making men feel guilty because they compete and win competitions. And they almost have to apologize for being a man if they are talented and successful. But we cannot blame the males for the fact that women are not always raised as competitors. And maybe we could see successful men in our industry as talented and inspirational. And the research of equality, which I'm all for, of course, in my opinion, shouldn't go through the elimination of the role of man in our society. And the problem I have with those movements is they kind of preach the no need of men. And it's just like this kind of separation and kind of fight now and between the genders. And I feel like we only talk about this instead of, okay, I'm not about dragging down men, but let's more be about raising women up with equal opportunities and push them to pursue their own passions and dreams, because they're incredible humans. And we don't care about their genders at the end of the day. If you're a man or a woman, you're just an amazing person and you should be an amazing coffee professional because you're smart and passionate and hardworking and I don't know, all those qualities.
And it is interesting because I feel like we're the first generation that we can actually see the fruits of how people have been raised with this a little bit different concept of it doesn't matter what you're born as, you can be whatever you want to be if you work hard for it. I mean, that's the spirit you got when you got raised up. That's the spirit that I got when I got raised, very differently, but still got it. And this thing that I really want to compete to prove myself. And I do have to say that every time I see a female competitor on the stage, it really motivates me because I'm kind of like annoyed. I'm like, well, if they do it every year and if they play so well, it's like there's no excuse for me to not play so well. So it is a inspiration in that point of view. So
absolutely.
I want to win this thing one time. In the moment, it doesn't really matter anymore what I'm gonna win. I just want to win something.
And you're gonna win it because you're amazing and your coffee is gonna be amazing. And I mean, your whole like routine and concept and things, like the quality of you, the experience you're gonna provide is gonna be unbelievable. It has nothing to do because you're gonna be a woman that you're gonna win. It's gonna be because of what you've done.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I do also have to say, like, in this, so you're talking so many true things and so many true factors that I also very much preach the whole time. Meaning, like, it is not just about us being angry feminists, it's about including the men on the table and inviting them to speak with us. But the problem is that whilst I seem that there's a generation that got raised with more liberty, it happened more to women than to men. So I don't know, I've talked to Matt recently, and he for them it's so hard to talk about this topic, so difficult, because they still don't get raised with being confronted with this. And in true life, or in real life, when I do work in hospitality, and when I was working as a chef, and when I was working behind the counter, there very truly still is this, how shall I say it, this like, you're being too dramatic, or it's fine, it's actually not like this. And then I actually really want to see the boss stuff like this. So this obviously comes from generations above us most of the times, but what I think is important is, going away from you being an extremely inspiring person that you are, is more about that, and I already said that in another podcast, it's more about speaking up when we see moments like this, because sometimes we live in a bubble where we think in the coffee industry everything's like perfect, and everyone is very equal, and everyone has equal opportunities and equal rights. But it is because we're very fortunate to think that, and because we're surrounded by very talented people, no matter what's their gender, while there's a lot of other places where this still isn't true, and it still isn't active, and it still isn't correct. So it still is important to talk about it. I know that it might be a tiring topic, and it might be a topic where a lot of us don't know why we have to talk about it the whole time. But the more we talk about it, the more normal it gets in everyday conversation and day-to-day life to talk about it, and the more we will finally reach the end of this chain where people are like, oh, yeah, that's actually really important to talk about what we want, what we think we should be treated like. And then it gets to this level where it has no gender anymore, because then men and women have the same rights.
Exactly. And that's right for all the industries.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. We hovered a little bit off our topic. Thank you so much, though. That was very, very that was very interesting. And now I have to do like a really poor leap back to where we were, because we were at 2016, where you compete in Dublin. and there you placed fifth, because you only want to improve once at a time, as you said. And then after Dublin, your career kind of like changed, right?
Yes, that's right.
So what happened then?
So I moved from France to Australia. That happened very quickly. I actually traveled to Australia for the first time in October 2016, as I was about to be hired by another roster in Sydney. And so I told Cosimo Libardo that I was around and that we should hang out for drinks. And he couldn't believe that.
Sorry. So Cosimo, I always have to explain the names. Cosimo was at the time working for Toby's Estate, right?
Yeah. He was the CEO of Toby's Estate back then. And so I told him that I was in Sydney and that we should hang out for drinks, because I knew him for like many years before. And he couldn't believe that I was about to consider a similar role for his competition. And apparently he told me he wanted to offer me the role of green coffee buyer as well. Because I was actually in Sydney, but I was invited by another roaster. And so when Cosimo found out, he's like, no, you can't go work for them.
He stole you.
Basically. So I think he ended up organizing it like much faster than he planned to do it. And I actually didn't know anything about Toby's Estate or about Australia at all. But all I knew was that I wanted to work with Cosimo. So I said yes, and I moved in February 2017 to Sydney.
And that was a big step for you, I guess.
Oh my God, yeah, that was huge. Like, moving from France to Australia is like, I don't think I could have gone any further, except maybe New Zealand. But
how was your English then?
I got better. Like, look, I'm still learning, but it was better, of course, than 2015. But yeah, look, because there is learning English and learning Australian English. It's they're not the same languages, as you know.
Yeah, yeah, very much. And then you had to settle in. Was it hard? Was it all super difficult, different?
Yeah, it wasn't so hard, but it was, I think Cosimo helped me a lot. So thank God he was here, like with me, like always having my back. And we had the same vision, and it was really clear what I needed to do in the company and why he brought me there. So it was really good to have him here and supporting me all the time. Because when you get, you know, into a new country and a new company where you're like kind of, you know, the new international person that has to get, I don't know, included in a team of people that have been working together for the last 10 years, it's always, it could be a little bit challenging. But like, yeah, Cosimo helped me a lot. And the fact he was always like on my side, and we always had like a really clear plan of what to execute, and was really, really helpful. And the team ended up being amazing too. So I was really lucky.
And then you could realize the differences, I guess, between the French coffee culture and the Australian coffee culture.
Yeah, it's huge.
So what is it? What is the French coffee culture like, and how is the Australian coffee culture like?
It's difficult, but let's say I feel like Australia is more open-minded and progressive. Also, like, one thing is Aussie have a much, like, big enough disposable income that people would be more willing to spend money for a better cup of coffee. Mm. I think in Australia, just the basic quality is just so much higher. Like, also takeaway is really strong. Like, the culture of takeaway coffee is huge, hence how businesses managed to survive during all those lockdowns. And in Australia, I think, like, what I would say that has changed, at least from when I arrived to now, is that there is more and more collaboration between producers, roasters, all the way to baristas. Also, like, there is a big push in terms of standardization and repeatability of the quality of extractions and service. Technology is really focused and being used to offer like high-end and regular, consistent experience to everyone. In terms of trends in Australia now, you have the thing around the optimal preservation of coffee with more and more freezing menus, reserve menus. You kind of build your own coffee cellar at home, which opens a lot of door for everyone. And I think we try to provide access to a high-end experience accessible to all, and also at home with projects of, you know, like different coffees and capsules and tea bags and drip bags, and to make at home, and that's replicable. And the thing in Australia is the standards of quality are like a different level than France. Like, France is like a century behind. It's like, I don't know about France. I admit that I have kind of lost track of what is happening there. But according to the coffee professionals I know and my last brief experiences when I came back, I have not seen a lot of change. And it's easy to say, being so far away and very little involved now. But France is stuck far behind when it comes to specialty coffee. And I imagine it's part of our past and part of our history as well. But today, the most difficult thing to deal with is the French mentality. That is really difficult to change or to challenge, and especially about a product that has been part of our history for many centuries. It's like French people feel a real danger in questioning themselves, you know? We usually have like this attitude of always thinking to know more or doing better than everyone else. You know, French people, they have a special connection with their history, but also many little cultural elements are added to increase our superiority to the world. You know, like the best gastronomy in France, of course. Mm-hmm. The most beautiful landscapes, they're in France. And the richest cultural heritage, still in France. Like, you know, we're French, like we're the best in the world, like in the universe. And So other countries think we are arrogant, of course, like we are, or that we are part of a like really blocked society. So we can't adapt to different codes. And that's definitely a problem. And it's a huge obstacle to be able to embrace such a new and innovative approach, which is the one of the specialty coffee industry. So I believe that's why it's so hard for French people, is because in our culture, like, you know, we always like, we're the best in everything we do. So why would we do any different? You know, I've always drink 100% Robusta and use like 7 grams of coffee and brewed it for 45 seconds. Like, what's wrong with it? It's delicious. No, but
it's really interesting, because I just had a conversation like this with a person from Chicago. And so if you look at Europe and the countries that are most proud, I think it's like the French, the Italian, and a little bit the Spanish, not as proud as the other two, but the countries that have the most pride have the worst specialty coffee.
It
just really is like this. And it is just like this person from Chicago that said, like, oh yeah, I feel like Europe just has a better coffee culture, and like we're just not as proud, and we admit that there's better stuff. It's like, have you ever heard a German walking around being like, I'm so proud to be German? It's just not a thing.
You're not allowed.
But I think because we're not allowed, it's we look a little bit more for what's out there. We're a little bit more curious. And this is what Australia is the country. There was a prime minister that once said Australia is the lucky country, because they were lucky because they're never in a war. They're never, nothing really ever bad in the last 100 years has happened to them.
Yeah, their story just started, to be honest. It's such a young country.
Exactly. So they didn't have this experience of losing everything. Well, this is super bad, because obviously the Aboriginal country has lost everything. So
they kind of eradicated every single one of them.
I certainly am just talking about the food and drinks culture now in the last 100 years. But that's why they're so curious about everything still.
Exactly.
And when I came to Australia, I've had the same thing, being like, I've never had this realization that people offer something and they offer it with their full heart and they push and push and push, and they're like, the customers will learn this. Whilst in Europe, we would stand there and be like, oh, they're not going to get it, they're not going to understand. And because everyone in Australia is pushing so much, and it's like, no, we can educate the customers, we can make them want better coffee. And because everyone is doing it, it actually really works. I've never seen this theory that we all as baristas have in our head, that we just like make better drinks and then people want better drinks. Never happened anywhere else so well as in Australia, I think.
Mm-hmm. But as you said, it's really a matter of attitude. It's all about the attitude from the barista, but especially the customers. That's the attitude of the society, that is just like, oh, it's exhausting just thinking about making a coffee in France, because, you know, like, people just don't even want to try, even if it's for free. So it's, I think it's really like a matter of, it's going to take time, probably, like, I don't know, many hundreds of years, to be honest, but... Hopefully it starts. Like, I know there was like many, many coffee shops opening and doing amazingly well. And mainly they trade on tourism. And it's not really the French people filling the places. But hopefully people will realize, oh, that coffee can maybe taste a little bit different. And it's okay if it does. But,
I'm also realizing that in within Europe, I have the benefit of Berlin being this little bubble that is really curious and is really full of growing and really, really adventurous. I think by now even more than London.
I agree.
Yeah, and so we have so many great coffee shops here. Everyone who ever wants to visit, just come. But still, there's still this hesitance of being like, oh, I don't know if people will understand. I don't know if people will buy this. So I think what we have to encourage is just doing it, just going for it, just setting the trends, which is exhausting and hard because you have to be really persistent. And I think the other thing that really helps is going out to the media. And you have kind of like done this because you've been an ambassador for many brands, so that people got to know you and people got curious and people wanted to hear your story. And you went on this competition stage to show yourself and to, make better coffee. Mm-hmm. And I think for Europe, this would be, because Australia is a running system, but I think for Europe, this is something that like coffee people can still do. They can still push the industry by just going out there and being persistent, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about also like, how are we going to connect this competition stage to the real world, you know, and to our real customers?
Mm.
And we have to find ways and being creative on how to translate this in our day-to-day coffee life, you know, because the problem with competition is it's just like a tiny little micro world, you know, where like, okay, we all know each other and we all know everyone, but how is it actually going to touch the customers and change our industry on a bigger scale?
Yeah,
I agree. It will at some stage, and we need to use it.
Yeah, I think Sasha did that very well. I think he's I still do have to say he's one of the champions, the world champions, that has, for me, connected the most dots in the industry by going to farms, going to the media, going to the press, and working on his business model. That I think, worldwide, he's done the most impact by his new fermentation and by all of the publicity jobs that he also does.
Yeah, amazing. Absolutely unbelievable. Yeah, I think he really managed to connect so well his work on the competition stage to the customers and what he's serving today in his cafes and to his, you know, wholesale business. And it's unbelievable.
Yeah, just this vision that he always had, and then just being like, yeah, no, we're going to do it. We're going to do it like that.
And people love it.
People love it.
It's really it gives a lot of hope to see that we actually can change things in the real world, not only on competition stage. That's what I think matters the most.
And it is so interesting. Maybe it's because I've just had it, but last week I went to Switzerland and I was working with a bunch of people with 4 coffee machines, and they actively said these words, like they actively said, yeah, but if the customer wants bad stuff, you need to produce stuff that makes the bad stuff. I was so shocked about this like mentality shift, because I was just like, no, if you only have good stuff, then the people want to come to you. You set the mark, the benchmark, and also assuming that all of the customers are stupid is like really backwards. I think I had another question for you at Toby's Estate. And your job at Toby's Estate is a green bean buyer, right?
It is.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that includes, what that job title means?
So I'm basically in charge of all the coffee buying for Toby's Estate, so both our blenders and micro lots. So I'm in charge of building the coffee program and sourcing the coffee for it. So I think like to be a green coffee buyer to me really is the closest to coffee I could ever be. That was my dream job, really. Like I'm tasting incredible coffees every day and get the chance to learn about the story behind every cup. I don't know if you know, but we buy coffee directly. So it means that I'm in charge of all the relationships with our coffee producers and exporters. I also get to build community and sustainability projects at Origin, as well as developing some research experiments. Every single coffee Toby's Estate buys has a really specific application and role to play into our coffee program. Either blender, micro lot, filter, espresso, as well as some other special projects and products. So each coffee or profile really serves its own purpose, and it has to make sense for the business. So because like we buy most of our coffee directly, it means that we are working closely with producers and exporters at Origin, and we do our own import for those coffees. And so the fact that we are taking the risk to cut the middleman, which is the importer, really allows us to have much more control, more transparency, more traceability about the coffees and the prices that we pay. But it's also risky on another hand, because our forecasting needs to be exactly precise. And as you know, for specialty coffee, it's mainly focused on freshness, which means that we need to anticipate the harvest, the season, the shipping times, and any unexpected situation. Like it's been happening for the last year or so. It's been kind of a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And then we have a warehouse close to the roastery in Sydney where we hold all of our green bean stock. And but again, like when you take the risk to do direct trade, this is when relationship and friendship, to me, it's really important. That really plays a huge role in what I do. And I spend a huge amount of my time building and caring about those relationships with those producers. So that's basically what I do.
So I have two curious questions. So the one is, because you always buy from the same producers, not always from the same, but you have relationships with the producers over a long time. What do you do if the harvest isn't good?
Like,
isn't that heartbreaking? What does one do then? Do you just say, sorry, it hasn't been as good?
It's more like, I think it depends on the producers and the scale of those producers, like what they would, the amount of coffee that they would produce and the qualities and what is the application for that coffee that you're gonna buy for. But let's say, like, if it's just a micro lot, and that you've been buying every year, and every year you expect, I don't know, an 85 points, and this year, I don't know, it's low specialty. All you can do is give really, really clear feedback on the coffee. And it's happened to me many times traveling to origin and actually cupping with producers themselves, and that coffee is horrible. And you have to look at them in the eyes and be like, I'm so sorry, but I can't buy this. This is not good. And then, but it's about like explaining to them what are you expecting from the coffee and what is the issue that you see in the coffee, and it's just about communication again. I think that's the most important point. And of course, it's heartbreaking, but that's, let's say, if you buy one little lot from one producer. But most of the time, you would buy a lot of different coffees. You would buy the high-end coffee. You would buy the low-end coffee. You would buy the blenders, the big volumes. So most of the time, even if one lot isn't going to be good, you're always going to have something else you're going to be able to buy. But every single case is like a one-on-one. Like, you can never really replicate thing. But again, like the fact that once you understand that the impact you can have when you are working on a larger scale like we do, everything becomes much more meaningful and exciting too, because we have the possibility to buy directly full containers. And this way we have a greater impact than buying a few pallets of, I don't know, 90 points micro lots coffees, even if you pay $30 per pound for each of those lots. And I think for me, that's what upsets me the most during like my travels. I see so many green coffee buyers do what they call like coffee hunting. Like they only chase, you know, the most rare and unique micro lots. Like they cup like dozens of tables until they find this really special coffee. And of course, I know they're willing to pay a really high price for it. But what quantities are they going to buy from this producer? One bag? If they can, maybe 35 kilo or 12 kilo vacuum packed box. And most of the times they're taking away from this farmer his very best lots and basically wasting the producer's time and money and only caring about the cream on top of the cake, you know? And of course, these roasters will bring home some incredible coffees from different farms. But what is the actual impact and relationship they build with this coffee producer? And I think when I travel, I try to have a full understanding about the producer's farm, what he produces, which qualities for which quantities. And from this, we try to build a fair price from this, or like different sorts of volumes as well, and application for his coffees. And of course, me too. I want to get the one bag of incredible diamonds coffee at like $20, $50, $100 per pound, but I would never ask for it unless I would also care about his 83 points and his 84 points coffees. And the thing is, I will probably be willing to bring full containers of this. And I think this is what makes the difference in the short and long term. Like, paying high prices for full containers of 83 points coffee has a much bigger impact than buying 35 kilo of fancy geisha.
Yeah.
Which is also much more representative of the reality of our specialty coffee market in terms of farming and also drinking.
Absolutely, yeah. What is it? So you said you also are in charge of some sustainability projects at Origin. What do they look like?
So last year we did this thing when like we worked with different exporters. And we gave back $10,000, of course, on top of the price we pay for coffee. That was not deducted mm-hmm. from it, but because we want to have a long-term relationship with them and keep buying from them for the future long-term, we try to invest in some projects. And so we, for example, in Nicaragua, we invested in a huge community kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So basically they build like a kitchen at the dry mill. Which will host all of their workers and provide like a free meal for every single lunch. And they can also have a clean place to have a nice shower and change. And because, you know, working in a farm and a meal is pretty exhausting and dirty as well. Mm-hmm. So people could have like a nice place to relax and enjoy a little bit of a break. In Brazil, we've been buying some... drying tables for a community in the south of Brazil to dry their coffee because it's so humid and cold that the coffee doesn't dry properly. And if you put it on the ground, like most of the time, it gets terrible defects. So we invested in a few drying tables for this community of women, actually, that grows coffee in the Paraná region. Ethiopia, we've built a primary school and we're paying for the salary of a teacher.
That is amazing.
We have a few like this. Like we try to expand them every single year, like having new countries and trying to get this across the line. Because again, like I know it sounds good and it's ethical and like in terms of marketing, you can use this as look like we mean well. But for me as a buyer, it's more like of a long term like investment in them. I'm like it's actually a selfish decision because I want those people to keep producing coffee for me.
Yeah.
And I want, because the biggest problem is people don't want to grow coffee anymore. Like the new generations, they just want to escape the farm because they realize it's not a sustainable business at all. And it's exhausting and it's not rewarding and you get terrible money. And the risks of a terrible harvest is always like just here at your door. Like it's so unstable that hopefully with those projects, like we also... In Guatemala, we work like we have we support a daycare, and we also like found like scholarships for people to study at a coffee university, where they would learn about like roasting, processing, like everything from like growing coffee to being a barista. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, they can see like, look, if you do everything right, and if you produce higher quality coffee than you are producing, hopefully you can make a living and you can get a fair price for your coffee. And please. Please keep growing coffee for us because we need you. So we're just trying to retain those new generations into the farm so they would keep growing coffee. And we see already the consequences of this year. I mean, you've seen the coffee prices, right? It's I think we're seeing the consequences of how we've been treating people.
It's super interesting because you're the first person in a long time that has talked to me about this. And the first time I've ever heard about this was during a SCA sustainability course. And they said that I think by 2022, which is now, which is not in the next year,
yes,
that a quarter of the people that were growing coffee have quit. Or we quit growing coffee, and a quarter is a lot. And
wow,
it is because it's such hard work and it's so badly paid.
I don't blame them. Yeah, and that's why for us, look, it's so important to do those little projects. Like I know it's not much, but if everyone is a little scale can do a little bit more, a little bit extra to value those people, and hopefully, like. Just give them some hope and some future, saying like, okay, it can actually be rewarding to grow good coffee.
Absolutely.
And even this is not enough. Like it's still like growing coffee is so difficult. It's so difficult. And the system we are in makes it even worse. Like, I mean, yeah, I can't blame them from wanting to quit coffee growing, to be honest.
Have you realized in the last couple of years that there's like less harvest?
Of course, like I mean, you've seen already now, like it impacted like this season a lot already. And it is a combination of many factors. Like, it's a really, really complex question with many, many things that are working together. And I feel like the main four, in my opinion, the things like you are impacting the price today, of course, is the yield of coffee, like the volume of coffee available in the world. The logistic chaos, like it's been absolute nightmare for the last 2 years to move coffee around the world. And the cost of productions, like we don't even realize, but the cost to produce coffee have went to the roof. So that's why people don't want to sell you coffee, because they would lose money if they would sell you coffee with the old prices that that we had last year. Like, it's been ridiculous. And and of course, like, less coffee due to the drought and the cold, like we had in Brazil as well. But it's not only Brazil, like everyone is talking about Brazil all the time, but it's all the countries have been suffering for those things, from those things.
I think there's a part in Kenya that didn't rain, and where it didn't rain since 1.5 years. How are they still surviving 1.5 years without rain? That is incredible. Kenya is so important for everything, but also for our coffee history, because if we lose this country as a grower, we lose a big part of the identity that shaped specialty coffee, I think.
And the drought has been huge, but everywhere, like as you said, Kenya and as you know, like Brazil had a really small crop. And again, it's not only Brazil. I know we always base everything on this country, but other countries in general had very small yield this season, like compared to what was expected. So there is a serious lack of coffee in the market. So I believe they had really intense drought in their last spring, I think, which for them is around September, which was supposed to be the blossoming time. Then in summer, let's say January, which is important time for the bean development, they had again a second wave of drought. So this impacted the production all over the country, and some producers' crop were 40% smaller than in 2020. It's ridiculous, and of course we're seeing a huge shortage, and we are worried that the world stock of coffee is reducing, hence the crazy prices. And you get the drought, but you also have the cold. And they had like unusual cold temperatures in Brazil this winter. And this has stressed even more the coffee plants that were already so stressed by this drought. And this damaged many different areas in the country and reduced even more the potential for 2022 crop. And I know, I think some projections talk around 6 million bags of Arabica lost for 2022 just because of the cold.
80 kilos, right?
Yeah. And and I think that, don't quote me on that, but they had the lowest temperature in Brazil in 70 years. And many parts of the country had snow and below zero temperatures, and which is not normal for Brazil, as you know. So lots of coffee growing areas were hit by the frost, which will now impact the production for next year, the 2022 crop, and probably the very affected areas will be impacted for 2 more years, because those poor trees,
they're dead. They need to heal.
And they take a lot of time to recover. They take lots of time to recover from the frost, because they would need to grow new branches again. And in some areas, trees have to be pruned. So it could mean, it could maybe mean 3 years with no production for them. And as you can imagine, some producers that were affected that bad, they are removing the coffee plantations and swapping to planting soybeans. So, of course, this also creates a feeling of less coffee available in the market for a few years, and consequently, the prices go up. So many factors. And
I have a question. Like, a lot of super smart people always come to me and they say it's because we're planting the wrong plants. So they say we should plant more Robusta because it is more robust and it is more stable against like weather crisis and everything, and easier to grow. And so I feel like in the last couple of months, I have been confronted with Robusta a lot. I had to cup a lot of Robusta. I had to drink a lot of Robusta. And I just gotta be honest. I just think it's awful. I just don't like the taste. I don't understand how people can like the taste. we see on the world stage that it's going exactly the opposite, back to like Eugenoides and Liberica, which are like really rare varieties. They're really hard to grow as well.
Yes, they are like
super hard. That's why they are on the stage, because they're like nearly have no, yeah, no benefits for the whole market. So we are drifting these two extreme opposite sides, where I feel like I'm in the middle and I don't know if I'm getting stretched apart, because I don't know what to do, because I would just love to say just keep buying Arabica, but apparently that now will seem as impossible in the future. What are we going to do?
Look, I wish I could have an answer to that question. But yeah, as you said, like, it's been a really big trend on the competition stage as well to see those new species like Eugenoides and Liberica, Racemosa and Robusta as well. And it's really interesting. But as you said, it's disgusting, right? Like it needs so much work to taste good. Like you need to do like unbelievable processing innovation, and you need to create specific yeast, and you need to be like a processing master to be able to make those coffees drinkable. I don't even say good, like drinkable, to make those pieces good. Like it's not good on its own. It's not good like Arabica is naturally, like, okay, you can just do a fully washed process and it will be drinkable already if it has no fault. But it requires just so much work to make those other species good that I don't know if it's an actual sustainable answer. Maybe in the future, I think it's great to open the door to new species, because we only know maybe a few of them and there are like hundreds of them. So I love that. I love that we get to discover new species, and it's so inspiring to see that like there is like those new experiments happening and those new discoveries, and maybe we'll find something exceptional and that will change the world, and I hope it will. But today it's also like in terms of prices, did you see like the prices of Eugenoides? Like it's great on the competition level, but again, it's going to be really hard to connect this to our industry on a bigger scale. And it's more expensive. It's not more expensive than a lot of geisha today. And Robusta look like, okay, they're resistant, but I don't think people are going to want to drink that.
But that is the thing. Like, I feel like, especially in France, but also in Germany, like, people seem to love Robusta, and I just don't get around. I just don't understand.
But there is a market for it, as you said, and it's great, amazing. Let's try to make Robusta taste better, and people also like when it doesn't taste good anyway. So it's great that there is a market for it. Then I wouldn't be going around farms and telling grower to grow Robusta, you know, like. I would never tell producers what to do anyway, but it's, who knows, like maybe climate change is like this now, but maybe in the next few years it's going to be the opposite way, and the Robusta plants are, I don't know, not probably going to be an answer for this either. So it's hard to read the futures and know what's going to be the best answer.
So I guess the biggest hope that we have in the moment is processing, right? To make a high quality processing that can, in this case, actually really manipulate flavor, more affordable and more doable on farm level.
Yeah, processing, as you said, but also like farming and also varieties. Like it's not only about species, but also like varieties, like doing like some interesting like hybrids and crosses. And that can be also an answer, like to kind of, you know, like incorporate a bit of this Robusta resistance into Arabica. And it's been done for many years, and it's working in some areas, and some are like disappointing in terms of taste profile and quality, but some are actually pretty unbelievable. So I think like there is hope in this area as well.
What was the best coffee you tried this year?
Oh, the best coffee I've tried this year.
Oh, even I have to think about that.
Oh, wait, it's hard.
Oh, I know the best espresso I've had. I've had it last week at Mame. It was incredible. What was it? I don't know. Just Tom Ballerin just made it for me, and I was standing there and I was like speechless. It was not bitter at all. I've never had a coffee like this, an espresso that was not bitter, just juicy and sweet, and I was blown away. I think it was a Kenyan CM, and I fell in love. It was, yeah, best coffee.
I was about to say, like, espresso. I think the best espresso I had this year was from Martin Backstage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From Kenya. Yeah. Yeah. It's Red Rue 11 and Bastion, like, espresso and as well milk base was ridiculous. Like,
I still have one in the freezer. I can't wait.
My God, that was that actually, yeah. And then in terms of filter, like, it's hard because I drink so many delicious coffees every day. I would say, like, right now, probably Bambito. It's a bit fancy to say that. Of course, it's delicious. But that would be my favorite coffee at the moment. I'm a big fan of washed, you know.
I think it's going to have a comeback soon. Like, the clean, washed Ethiopia and Kenya.
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously have to say that my best coffee was my competition coffee, obviously.
Of course, it has to be.
But then what else? Coffee that really blew my mind. I think actually, again, Tom Ballerin, the one that he used for the French Brewers Cup. It's called Napoleon, which was I thought was really fitting. But those beans were just like a dessert, like a rum and raisin dessert.
Yeah, it's a big boy.
Yeah, it is a big boy, yeah. Very big boy coffee.
Nice. I had an amazing SL28 from Las Lajas as well, from Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. Like this natural process, but like, you know, the clean, fruity, unbelievable acidity, like, the kind of natural process coffee I'm in love with. And for me, like, it's the best combo, like Costa Rica with SL28. I'm just like, look, it can't get any better.
I'm really excited. I think I have samples coming from Nicaragua and from El Salvador. And I think they're all carbonic macerations. So I think they're in the moment they're stuck in customs. So I have to call today and I hope they're going to get released. It's really difficult.
I hope as well.
To get anything into Germany. Thank you, Brexit.
Oh, right. Oh, God. Especially with the, logistics has been like a nightmare, to be honest, this last year and a bit. Like, I think that's what also is driving coffee prices to the roof.
But sometimes it's not even coffee prices, it's just shipping prices.
Exactly, shipping prices. It's nuts. Like, the money it costs you to move one container now is like 4 times the prices it used to be.
Yeah, no joke. When I bought the coffee for my competition, it was 120 kilos and it was from Kuwait. And we had to pay 2,500 euros for shipping.
Wow. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
They actually, like, and this is, you're afraiding it, but I think due to the pandemic, like, some countries are not even letting ships into their countries. So this started to happen last year, and this situation starting like clogging the whole world logistic process, and containers started to be delayed and delayed and delayed to the point there were not any available anymore. And now imagine it's not only for coffee, it's for everything. So for us, like, logistics been like an absolute chaos. Like, Australia is already 3 times more time to bring coffee than anyone else in the world. But now, instead of, for like, usual 5 to 6 weeks transit, some boxes took 3 to 4 months. Can you imagine? And we're facing cases of cargoes rolling over 3 or 4 times in a row now, and that creates huge delays for us. So it's quite frustrating because you can't do anything about it. You just wait there and you just have to adjust all of your shipment months and hope to make sure that you keep a bit of a safe stock cover, you know.
Does it make sense for you? Because I think you have climatized storehouses, right? Because it's so hot.
Yeah. Like, it's not like we don't have like a full refrigerated room, but we have like ventilation as much as we can.
That's Does that make for sense us, like, to, if you would have like a gigantic like cool room? I guess it's too big, right?
That would be my dream, of course.
So you can actually store coffee longer if you reduce the temperatures of your surrounding, right?
Yeah. We're actually working on building like a little cool room for best microlabs. Again, like we always try to use coffee the freshest possible. Look, that's why our forecast is always like really precise on the seasons of every single country we bring in. But of course, like having temperature and humidity control is luxury.
Do you have experience with like freezing green?
Yeah. Like it's.
Does it roast the same? Because I think the things that I've tried, the roast profiles were not that different.
Yeah, it's pretty close. I think it's about how you let it like come to temperature and the pace at how fast are you freezing it and how fast are you unfreezing it.
So you have to unfreeze it before you roast it. I didn't. I just froze it. I just roasted it frozen. Just chuck it in.
Just chuck it in, like let it like put ice in your roaster, it's fine.
Well, it was a small roaster. It doesn't matter if you put 50 grams in and they're frozen. It's just that they're unfrozen in like a second.
But look, it's really interesting. And I believe there is so much work and research to be done even more deeper into that topic. Again, like freezing, I don't think would be necessary to freeze green bean, like unless like you want to keep them for like the next 10 years, of course. But just for like a season and a bit, I think just cold temperature and
I think it's an interesting thing for people that are competing, actually, because inside story, Wojtek, the competitor who competed in Germany and who placed fifth in the world for barista in Boston, he was competing with Eugenides and he didn't use it all and he froze the green beans and he used it again this year to qualify for the Polish Barista Championship.
No and way!
He got like he forgot all of his. What did he forget? Forget some of the things you should have said. I don't know if it was tactile. He forgot to say the tactile of the coffee. Oh, so no. He completely lost points on that. But otherwise, if he wouldn't have lost the points on that, he would have beaten the fresh crop of Eugenoides.
Wow.
Which is incredible.
Wow. I love that.
He froze those beans for 2 years. And just it shows how great you can preserve coffee because you buy this coffee and it is. Mm-hmm. An arm and a leg, that's how expensive it is. It is so incredibly expensive. But the fact that he could store it over the whole pandemic and then use it when he wants to is mind-blowing for me. I think this is great because then we have so much more value in those expensive beans.
Yeah, and it's amazing as well as a coffee professional, like if you love one specific farm or have a specific relationship with the producer, to buy his harvest like every single year. And I don't know, in 10 years you'll have the library from his like 2021 crop to his 2031 crop, and you can compare his evolution year in, year out, of like, you know, the evolution of the trees and the maturation and all those things. Like it's unbelievable. It's a great tool.
Because it is crazy. I've just tried a couple of geishas and I was copying them and I gave my feedback and I'm like, they're not really there yet. I feel like those plants, they taste too, the coffee place too, it tastes too young. And the producer was quite, he was like, yeah, they're actually like super, super young trees. They need to develop longer. And I'm like, oh, this would be great to like monitor and to see how they go.
Yeah.
And like,
and especially, I agree, for producers, it's an amazing, amazing thing to do.
We've been chatting since a long time.
Did we speak too much?
Intense. This is an intense, very professional talk.
I'm ready to talk more. Tell me what you want to talk about.
I think we might get over our usual timeline that we usually have for this podcast. We've talked about how you ended up in coffee and how you started competing, and what I really loved is that fact that a random barista just made you coffee and invited you to do these classes and to learn more, because this is so rare nowadays. I think that it's very rare that I go to a coffee shop. The pandemic has done a lot to the motivation of the young baristas, but if there's anything that I would like to say to young baristas that listen to this podcast, is like, this is how a lot of us actually started in coffee. It's like they were motivated people and they made us, they fascinated us. And this is why It is important that baristas still do this and still inspire and still do those little free cuppings or free degustations. I actually have one more question to you, Charlotte.
Tell me.
There is such an extreme staff crisis in the moment in Europe because people don't want to work in cafes anymore. Fair enough. Yes. I mean, they lost their jobs during the pandemic and so they're the least important people. What do you think we can do for like the young barista, I don't know, the young emerging baristas to actually like keep an interest in the job and stay in the job? Because we're facing nearly the same thing that the farmers are facing, where people aren't interested anymore in doing what we are doing. Are there any motivational things that we could do?
I mean, I think it's really about the company you're working for. It's a tough one. Like, I believe it really depends on the company you're involved in. And lots of baristas could have different paths, like from barista to wholesale or training. And there are actually like many career paths for barista. And being just a barista is amazing. And I think you will never stop learning just in this field of brewing, extracting coffee and service. And I think you need to find the right company that will support your personal growth. And there are so many things from being a barista, roasting, buying. Then there is the sales and marketing side of the businesses. And of course, there is also the producing part and the exporting part. So just I think the advice I would give is get interested into every single aspect of the supply chain. Mm. And again, like, don't be scared to ask questions, and there will always be people more experienced than you are. And I think like we all have this little like, you know, complex, we all feel a bit insecure sometimes and sometimes we're a bit ashamed, like you're doing a cupping with people and you don't know if you're going to say the right things and if you're going to look stupid. And honestly, it's really about your attitude and your approach, and no one is preventing you from knowledge. And this is what will bring you this confidence, and it's all about yourself and your choices, your conviction. And I think like, yeah, it reminds you to be humble and should push you to get more opportunity to learn and improve. So yeah, get inspired and look up to someone, that, I don't know, inspire you. It can be like anyone in the industry and yeah, and the value behind it. I understand the feeling of being sometimes unconfident or impressed when you're like surrounded by really knowledgeable or experienced people, but try to use this at your advantage and learn something from those people. Mm. That's my advice.
Yeah. And also, yeah, I think what you also said is like just learn and grow and take this growth as something that you can later on use. I have mm-hmm. the feeling that a lot of people don't even... they get stuck at being a barista and they're so demotivated and then they just stop instead of actually like looking for jobs in the industry. Like, it's so easy. We have LinkedIn now and we have Facebook and we have Instagram and there's always people searching. And I think people should use those opportunities to actually like look, oh, what do I want to do actually? Are there other jobs in this industry that might be interesting for me? And I think that's what we all can agree on is the base should always is actually often that you have worked in a cafe or have experience with like customers or as a trainer or anything like this. But this base can give you so many more opportunities in the future.
Exactly. And it's again, like some barista are just barista because it's their student job. Like, they just want to pay the bills and they don't really care about coffee, for example. And it happens most of the time. But then if you realize you're really interested and passionate about coffee, then look for a company again that's going to support you into learning new things, and not going to just put you in this barista box and do your shift and shut up, you know, like a company that's going to try to support you in growing and learning more.
And I have to say that when I was working in Australia, I was so amazed by all of the students that I worked with that are actually so passionate about what they're doing, and they have the easiest answer ever why they do this. It's because they don't want to work in something that doesn't bring them joy. So they start working in a coffee shop and they get so much inspiration and they got so much background information from all of the people around them that they start loving the job so much, even if it is just next to them studying. And I loved that attitude. I loved that embracing of the topic itself, and then like, yeah, motivating everyone around you.
Yeah, that's amazing.
All right, Charlotte, it is time. It really is time. Thank you so much for having this long chat about, yeah, about your coffee career, about feminism or what feminism could be or should be, and about your whole background of green bean buying. This is so interesting, and about new varieties and things that we have to face in the future for the industry. I hope to see you super soon. I think the next time we could see each other is actually in Australia, in Melbourne, for MICE, when the World Barista Championship is on, and that is in September. Fingers crossed that nothing's going to happen until then, and there's not going to be any changes. yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I can't wait to see you in Melbourne.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It's going to be so much fun. It's also, I think we definitely need to take 2 more weeks and then just, yeah, visit the family and visit everyone in Australia.
Absolutely.
Yes, so we can see us in Sydney. We can have a nice wine night.
Oh, yes. Lock it in.
Cool. So, Charlotte, the last words of this podcast go to you, to anything that you wanted to say. I already say thank you so much. So the stage is yours.
Well, thanks to you, Nicole, for inviting me on your podcast. It was amazing to get to chat about all those things. And sorry if I spoke too much. I know I can speak about coffee and, you know, all these prices things and cost of production and like for ages. So I'm sorry.
No, it's perfect. It was so interesting. I feel so much smarter now.
And yeah, I hope to see you soon in real. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much. So have a wonderful day, and I say bye.
Bye.
So at this point, I would like to thank Rancilio Germany again for supporting this podcast episode. And I have to admit that this was probably one of the most enjoyable interviews I have had. And I've learned so much in the last hour. I love Charlotte's views on feminism, and I'm just actually really proud because I love this podcast episode, and I hope you will love this too. If you have any questions or if you just want to shoot me a message, please feel free to contact me via my website, which is nicolebutterfeld.com, or just DM me via Instagram, and the handle is nbutterfeld. And now it's time to say thank you so much for listening, and I hope I can hear you the next time for the She's the Barista podcast.